The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Everyone. My name is Laura Kovacs, and I'm honored to introduce our guests this evening. Ayanna Mathis's first novel, The 12 Tribes of Hattie, was a New York Times bestseller, second selection for Oprah's Book Club 2.0, a 2013 New York Times Notable Book, NPR Best Book of 2013, and was long listed for the Dublin Literary Award. Ms. Mathis received her MFA at the Iowa Writers' Workshop and went on to become the first African-American woman to serve as an assistant professor in that program. She currently teaches at Hunter College's MFA program. Her new novel, The Unsettled, is set in turbulent 1980s Philadelphia and the small town of Bonaparte, Alabama. This evening, she'll be joined in conversation with Asali Solomon, an award-winning novelist and the Bertrand K. Wilbur Chair in the Humanities at Haverford, where she is a professor of English and director of creative writing. Please welcome our guests to the Free Library.
Hi. I'm so happy to be here, and I'm so happy to see such faces. Oh, there's Akiba. And there's my cousin and my aunt. And a lot of other people. I'm going to stop being weird now. So what we figured we'd do is I was going to read a little bit. Not too long. Don't feel dread in your hearts. And then Asali and I are going to talk. And then hopefully y'all will ask some questions. And that's what we're going to do. Okay. The first part of the novel, I'm going to read from each part of the novel. It's in two parts. The first part of the novel is set in a homeless shelter where our character, two of the main characters, one's named Ava, the other one's name is Toussaint, her son, are living. And then in the second part of the novel, these same two people go to, let's call it a group with utopic aspirations. So for now, I'm going to read from a section that takes place in the shelter. This chapter's called Family Day. "Honey," Ava said, sitting up in bed, wild-eyed. "Quick, get dressed." It was already 10:30. Toussaint sat cross-legged on his bed across from his mother. "Today is Labor Day," he said. Ava's hair was smashed in on one side. "But here they call it Family Day. There's a sign in the hallway." Toussaint didn't like it when she slept late. It reminded him of the mornings after she and Abemi had one of their fights back in New Jersey. That's the man that Ava was married to. Those mornings he spent sitting on the floor by the bed, watching his mother curled on her side as the hours ticked by, 11, noon, 1. Toussaint had gone to the cafeteria while Ava slept. 2 weeks at Glen Avenue, and this was the first time he'd gone anywhere alone. He had rehearsed the routine in his mind. Take the tray from the stack, just like at school. Take the fork, tell the lady what you want, hold the tray steady, sit. Take the tray, hold the... But the cafeteria was heaving with people. Red sweatpants and pink foam curlers, hard rollers, black tracksuit, bright green slippers, ashy heels, mother and daughter, gold earrings, edges pressed, duck pajamas, toothpaste smudge on a chin. The lady at the counter asked him if he wanted toast, but when he opened his mouth, he couldn't form the words. He sat in a corner, choking down the rubbery eggs, but at least he didn't cry. He didn't run away either. "There's barbecue," he told his mother now. She had gotten out of bed at last. "They were talking about it in the cafeteria," he added when she didn't answer. "You went to the cafeteria by yourself?" she asked. After he'd finished his eggs, he smuggled out a piece of toast and a banana to save his mother the trip when she woke up. He pointed at the little bundle sitting on the desk. "Nobody said anything," he said. Toussaint peered out into the hallway as Ava brushed past him on her way to the bathroom. Family Day had got itself up and running. New faces in the corridor, most of them smiling. Music playing. Men's voices boomed out of the propped open doors of the rooms. Kids squealed at the fathers and uncles and older brothers who'd come to see them. Someone set up a boom box in the playground and propped the door open so the little kids wouldn't get their fingers smashed in the metal door frame. A teensy, pot-bellied brown girl in an orange shirt was laughing her head off and offering everybody the drooly leftovers of her icy pop. Toussaint smiled, too. Ugh, what confusion, Ava said when she returned to their room a few minutes later. These people are a mess. Toussaint thought it was all a little bit joyful, and it was just that his mother couldn't see it. I think it's fun, he said. Oh, honey, Ava replied, shaking her head. There's no fun here. Toussaint opened the long windows. He sat cross-legged on the top of a desk. If he held his head at the right angle, he could see the edge of the AMP parking lot across the street. He stared at the ankles of the people milling on the trampled grass just outside. They're barbecuing, he said. The hot dog hamburger smell hung in the air. Earth, Wind, and Fire played on the radio in the playground. Boogie on down. Boogie on down, Toussaint mouthed. Then just like that, he had memoried himself all the way back to New Jersey. He could taste the spicy gumbo at his friend Paul's house and the milk he drank after, silky, creamy, and cooling his mouth. Paul's mother always had a pot of something good bubbling on the stove. Call me Jilly, she said the first time they met. No miss, just Jilly. Jilly knew every card game there was. You don't know how to play nothing? Not even gin rummy, she'd asked. They're holy rollers, her son Paul had explained. He hadn't meant anything by it. He'd never been to church, not one time. He asked if he could come with Toussaint some Sunday, just so he could see what it was like. Jilly taught Toussaint to play blackjack. Hopefully Jesus won't get mad, she said, and winked. She was always laughing, and it sounded just like the telephone ringing, bells, bells, bells. And she was always in a slip when he and Paul got there after school, and she smelled like sweet candy, like if you could make candy out of flowers. Her hair was in pin curls, and she walked from stirring the kitchen pots to changing the records in the living room, back and forth with the mascara wand in her hand. At some point late in the afternoon, she put on a dress and heels and click-clacked out the door. See you later, babies, she called on her way out. Jilly was just like a movie. When she was gone, Paul took control of the turntable. They had the whole world to themselves. You know Sylvester? Paul asked. You know Martha Wash? He was 3 years older. He gave Toussaint an education. They played songs 10 times, 15 times, till they knew every word, every break in the beat. The house smelled of Jilly's cooking. The setting sun cut the living room into gold and shadow. Music thumped in the floors. Family room was loud as if it was happening right in their very room. Toussaint wondered if people were dancing out in the hallways. You can do the hustle to just about anything, Jilly had once said. Toussaint didn't know if his mother could do the hustle. He thought she used to know. Before Obey Me, she probably knew. Maybe she had done the hustle with his father, but Toussaint couldn't picture Cass dancing, like Magneto wouldn't dance. And glide like a 747 and lose yourself, he sang under his breath. Ava sat herself down at the desk with one of those stupid coloring books they'd given him. His coloring books. Not that he wanted them, but still. What are you doing with that? He asked. Ugh, these gnats, she said, waving her hand around. There were only gnats because she hadn't eaten the banana he'd given her that morning. Close that window, honey. It's just letting bugs in. But Ava didn't reply. She was in one of her moods. She was like a big, tall mountain with clouds so thick around it you couldn't see the top half. It was cold up there behind those clouds. On a real mountain, that is, which Toussaint knew from geography class. If you tried to climb one, you'd have felt like you were the only person on earth. You'd have felt so lonely you could die. I'll stop there. And then I'm going to read something different than I thought. I think think I'll read the other part of this novel. We've read Philadelphia. The other part of this novel takes place in a mythical place called Bonaparte in Alabama. And the beginning, it's such an important town in the life of this book that I thought it needed to have a myth, like an origin myth to start it out. So I'm gonna read you a couple of pages of its origin myth. It is in another of the narrator's voices. Her name is Duchess. In the beginning was the Alabama River. Sunrise, dusk, starling flight. Gators, sunfish, Spanish moss, live oak, mountain lion, lark, muskogee, Alabama, Choctaw. Bonaparte wasn't yet Bonaparte because all the niggers were still in Africa not knowing they were going to become niggers. No Huntress or Isabella full of Africans sold to Quakers, no Clotilda sunk off the coast of Mobile. All the white folk still up in their cold places fighting each other. Ooh, they sure was coming though, and when they did, they wanted to conquer death and time. They came down on the world like the rain came down on Noah. They wanted to be the rain and Noah and God too. What they don't know is God helps people invent the God they deserve. White folks have Zeus, popes, dollars, big motherfuckers that suck the bones of tender things. Scared all the real gods into hiding with their cannon fire, burning forests, whales trailing blood under all the oceans. Big teeth chomping up all the Indians, every wood and every plain. Ships filthied the waters with our mothers sealed below the decks. Topside, the sails clapped and the wind blew the crew's hair and whipped their lice into the foaming water. Their souls went too. Damnation haunts their generations. Bonaparte is how the white people called this place on the banks of the Alabama River. It was green and greener, even after they got some bodies to fell the trees. Some bodies planted cotton, planted sorghum, more cotton. Them motherfuckers didn't know what they was doing. Could have asked the Muskogee, but they drove them like dogs to Oklahoma. Could have asked the niggers, but you know. The earth turned on them, told you they was cursed, and sent plagues of insects. We had our kitchen gardens, we had our chitlins and pig feet, we knew how to eat around little bones. Floods came. God said, float. Niggers made rafts out of wood. First master drowned, washed up, covered with leashes. Second master, smallpox. Third, tuberculosis. Four master's sons all died on the same full moon night. Shit, them spirits don't play. Our mothers neither. Massa so shook up he came down to the cabins, his thing soft and in his pants for once. What happened to my sons, he wants to know. Should have put blood on your door, old Rhea said. He gave her the bit, sure. But 3 weeks later, he was dead too. Heartbreak, you reckon. After that, there was a lull in masters. The story goes that old Rhea took to standing at the river's edge, looking across the water. One's coming, she'd say, every decade or so. Then she turned her back and walked into the woods. Wouldn't nobody see her until that new master grew a goiter on his throat and strangled or got burnt up in a slave cabin, the brown girl in it with him outside, warming her naked self by the flames. The war came and went. Evidently, we all got freed, but nobody in Bonaparte heard about it till long after that, because by then, wouldn't no folk, white folks blight our shorelines or our woods or our fields. Bonaparte farmed. People made shiny-eyed babies with minds quick as rabbit traps. Old Rhea kept watch on the shore. One day, who could say how many decades it passed, one day old Rhea said, one's coming. White folks troop up the road, big eyes staring because they never saw the like. Our men with no yeser in their mouth, the women looking them straight in the eye. Fields neat as ironed handkerchiefs, big fat cows everywhere. The white men say they got new plans for a new time. New time, says Bonaparte. 1936, they say. The plans say the government decided to give Bonaparte to the people, even though the people already had it. Rhea said, let them, but don't tell them nothing. So it went. They did their surveys and drew up their deeds. Everybody signed. When it was done, Bonaparte gathered by the river at dusk. Rhea said, everything born on this land, everlasting knows by name. Anything come for us, God rise against it. through us. We are God's vengeance and blessing. Then Rhea, she was something old by then, raised her arms up to the woods, and up come a flock of starlings swelling the sky. They're still there, every night, a wave of surging black across the twilight. You should see them. Oh, you really should. Stop there.
Thank you. Okay, I was also testing the mic.
I know. You're welcome.
Thank you. But you were saying that you hadn't really figured out the sections to read, but it seemed like you'd read those a lot. I mean, there was even singing.
I think it's from writing those sections, right? Like the singing part. You know, 'cause I could always hear him. You know, I guess he's like 11 at that point. I could always hear him in my mind, like mouthing these songs to himself because mom won't let him go outside.
Yeah, right. Okay, now I get to ask questions. So what was the beginning of this for you? Mm. It has so much in it, right? So I'm just wondering, like, what's the kernel that it forms around?
I think I sort of always knew, well, let me backtrack. I mean, I was working on it for 8 years, almost 10 probably, actually. But two of them I don't count because it was kind of, sort of a different book at that point.
Yeah.
But when I kind of got to the point where I was like, okay, I think that this is what this book is, I knew always sort of how it would end. So I'm not going to tell you how it would end because spoiler alert, obviously. But I knew that it had something to do with MOVE, even though it is not MOVE. So I knew that kind of. And then I also knew, because I got really lucky, that voice, the last voice that I read, the sort of origin myth, Duchess is that character's name. She came really early on, too, even though I didn't really know where she belonged. But there was this voice of this, like, itinerant blues singer who I knew wasn't anymore and was probably in her 70s and lived in some sort of, like, rural place that had been an important place. And I didn't know what her storyline was or kind of what her deal was, really. But I knew it, that she the thing had to kind of form around her.
Mm-hmm. But it's interesting because that takes place in Alabama, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas I'd say most of the action takes place in Philadelphia, mm-hmm. right? What did you want to do by putting those places in connection? I mean, it like revisits your earlier novel in terms of thinking about like the Great Migration. But like, I don't know, talk about that.
Yeah. I mean, I think there were a couple of things. I mean, so I mentioned that without too many spoilers, in the second half of the novel, Ava and her son kind of gravitate toward this group that is a black, very political group that is like mostly my imagination, but also like a little bit Black Panthers, a little bit Weather Underground, a little bit maybe sort of MOVE in the sense that they compost and things, but very interested in Black freedom and in autonomy and in forming a kind of utopic community in which they get to sort of like live outside of the norms of society, you know, whatever those are, right? And also the place that Duchess lives in, where Ava came from, was a place like that. That's the origin myth that I read. And that place existed for a very long time, over 100 years before when the novel opens and we meet it. There are literally 5 old people left in this place trying to kind of hold on to it. And so I think of Bonaparte as a real place and also kind of a spiritual homeland. And I also wanted, as I wrote in, I realized that I was really interested in conversations about communities that attempt to create something that is like autonomy mm-hmm. and something that is like freedom. And that I was also interested in the violence, various sorts of violence mm-hmm. that those kinds of communities might encounter. And so I wanted these places to be in conversation with each other. And I also wanted one to be kind of a dark mirror of the other, which I think is sort of what Philadelphia is, like those Philadelphia sections, the group there is called ARC. And I think that ARC is formed by someone who is right about a whole lot of things, but has some kind of messed up intentions and some really messed up methods. Mm-hmm. And so though in the ways in which Bonaparte thrives when it did, you know, and was a place of like of safety and a haven and all these kinds of wonderful things, ARC is much less that kind of place. So I wanted to I wanted a lot of mirroring, and I think that probably happens a lot in the book, like particularly about those two places. But I think in other ways too, like I was making a joke to a friend of mine. I was like, I think I basically just wrote the same book twice, like, but, you know, and then, like, sat in different places with like different circumstances. But
yeah. So what did you learn writing this book?
I mean, I don't even know where to begin. I learned, you know, I've always had this theory, you know, sometimes people will say, you know, when people say to you, like, well, you know, you've probably answered a big question with this book, or like, what are your conclusions, you know? And what I discovered, which I suspected, and used to say to my students before I think I really was sure, was that I don't think that I have written a book that kind of answers any questions, but rather just explores a lot of questions. Mm-hmm. And I think in the long trajectory of getting this book written, I think that I thought for a while that I could answer some questions. Mm-hmm. And then what I realized is that that wasn't my job, and then I couldn't do it anyway. Like, I didn't have any of the answers to any of these questions. And so that what I had to do was to ask the best sorts of questions and describe the world from which those questions would arise the best that I could. And that was an enormous writing lesson, and it was also an enormous lesson about just kind of being a thinking person and like trying to get through the world as it is now, in which it often seems that it is utterly impossible to have any sort of answer about anything, mm-hmm. but that maybe what is possible is to record things and to keep asking questions and to keep trying to question better. So it was sort of a writing lesson and a life lesson.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's interesting because I think like one of the most difficult things that any writer does is to write a second book.
It's horrible.
So like, what did you feel like you learned about yourself and writing in this process?
That I didn't know how to do it. I mean, you write your first book and you're like, oh, okay, cool. You know, I did that, you know. And then I was like, all right, well, I don't want to be a one-hit wonder. I got to write a second book. I was like, I don't even know if I would want to write a second book. I was just
thinking about retiring.
Exactly.
Like,
oh, yeah,
I already did that.
That's
yeah.
enough, you know. Right. So, you know, but it's impossible. I mean, sophomore novels are just a nightmare. They take forever. There's all the sort of pressures, you know, I feel like if a novel was really successful and I got so lucky with Hattie, then there's all the pressures of that follow-up. If that hadn't been the case, there would still be all this pressure because then I would have been like, I've got to do better than the first time. You know, no matter what, it's horrible and takes and endless. And interestingly enough, you know, it's like writing is such a private thing, right? Like, it's such a quiet, private thing. And once you have a book out in the world, regardless of how that book is received, there are now eyes and voices and opinions and things that are in your mind and sort of in your spirit, and you have to kind of go through this process of getting rid of them in a certain way, or at least finding something to do with them so that you can get... I don't think you can ever be a debut novelist again, right? Like, you can never be writing your first novel not knowing anything about anything about the industry. You can never go back there.
Right.
But maybe... you can find some... A mentor and very dear friend of mine said to me once when I was really struggling about this, and she said, and I think it's just wise about everything, not just second novels, but she said that in time I would grow accustomed to navigating the revised circumstances of my existence. And which is like amazing and utterly true and took a long time, but was what it took.
I mean, right? Also just about getting old or something. Too.
Also, right? Exactly. Like, you know, yeah, like the hips and all that.
So who was your favorite character to write and who gave you the worst time?
Duchess. Favorite, sorry.
Okay.
She's so distinct. She came early on. She was clear. I mean, I didn't know what to do with her.
Right.
But the voice was just like clear. She, and I got lucky because she was clear, but she was complicated, right? Like, her mothering and her motherhood and her approach to motherhood is complicated. Her relationship to this place that she is now stewarding, I guess, that would be Bonaparte, is complicated. Her relationship to her daughter is incredibly complicated. Her relationship to her past is complicated. But she is brave and wisecracking and sort of doesn't generally want to admit those things about herself. So she was just a gift. The hardest character by far was Ava. Hmm. By far. Ava is sort of the, you could call her the protagonist, but I don't know. I mean, I sort of think it's all three of them. But so Ava is sort of that voice in the Philadelphia sections in the novel. And she just, she was just so difficult. She didn't want to talk to me. I couldn't hear her voice. And when I did, I think I was like judging her, and then she would get mad. She didn't want to come around.
Why did you want to write her so much? What did you want to do with a character who got on your nerves?
Because it needed her. Yeah. There needed to be this woman with this child who was trying to navigate a complicated but glorious past, who for whatever reasons, which I won't get into, but partly because she just has beef with her mom, refuses to return to that glorious past and is looking for something else. I seem to be very interested in motherhood and in mothers who, you know, I was joking to a friend that I'm just going to keep writing novels about failed mothers. And they're not failed in the sense that they deeply love their children, but they are not, the ways in which they show that are not always recognizable, sometimes not to their children, most problematically. I guess it's kind of the same with Hattie, theme. But anyway, so they, you know, so I knew that she needed to be there, and I knew that she was interesting if I could just, like, tune out the static and kind of hear her. Also difficult because the first half of the novel takes place in a homeless shelter. I mean, it's interspersed with these Bonaparte sections. And it was like, she's, you know, she's depressed, she's having a hard time. And so there's, as it turns out, a pretty good deal happens, but it doesn't seem like much to me for a long time. It felt like I just had to write in stasis, like this woman's just kind of wandering around this shelter being depressed. And I didn't know how to animate that. I was like, well, this is just going to be the same day. It's just Groundhog Day, but like really depressing because it's in a homeless shelter. You know what I mean? So it's like, what am I going to do with this? You know? So that also was really hard with her.
Yeah. So I saw in your bio that you're a student at Union Theological.
I am.
Is that true?
I am.
And so, and I've been reading your essays in the Times about faith. Mm. What's, talk about the decision to have the, use everlasting in place of God for overwhelmingly the book. I think there's like two mentions of actual like God, right?
Mm-hmm. There are many reasons. So one of the reasons is that I didn't want to use gender pronouns with God. And I didn't want, and everlasting as a term kind of came very organically one day when I was working on it. And I think maybe I had been using God for a while, but then had been running into some very like thorny, ugly syntactical problems. Because if I want to refer to God, but I don't want to say he, then, you know, the sort of theological thing currently would be to say, like, you know, instead of saying him would be like God or God's self, or, which I think is very beautiful. But like saying that over and over again in a novel does not, I can tell you, does not work. So it was like, okay, if I'm not using gender pronouns, if I'm not, then what, like, what could I do? There's got to be some way around that. And of course, the pronoun thing is just the tip of the iceberg, right? Because I don't believe in, and nor do I think that these people, particularly in the Bonaparte sections, I don't think they believe in a gendered God. Like, I don't think they believe in a God that is a he. I think they believe in a God that is like a little bit Christian and a little bit like, you know, in the river and in the plants and in the trees. And that God is sort of an amalgam. And so also God, in the way that we might think of it, would evoke immediately like a Christianity that is super recognizable.
Yeah.
And while that is part of their faith system, it's also something else. Right. So I needed another term for the way that they would think about God, which would be this omnipresent, powerful force that is, in fact, of course, everlasting, but that is not sort of pinned down specifically to Christianity, certainly not pinned down by gender.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Who do you want to read your work?
I want Black people to read my work. I really want Indigenous people to read my work, because I think also that there's a lot in here about land. You know, Bonaparte is, you know, it's land that that the ancestors, so all the people in the book are black. And so it's land that their ancestors were brought to, of course, as enslaved people, and land that they stayed on, you know, kind of miraculously. You know, you heard the origin myth, while the masses just up and die, you know. So there they are, like, independent in the middle of, like, the slave years in the South. It's a little mythological, but, you know, one of the things that they are very well aware of and that comes up in the book is that they'll say over and over, you know, they're aware that they're, like, stewards, or at least they're trying to navigate their relationship to the land, because they're like, well, it's... This is the only home that we have, and so we preserve it and we keep it and we want to leave it for our children, and it has allowed us to be safe and to have some degree of freedom, but we're very well aware that this isn't our land, right? Like, it's native land, it's stolen land, and so there's a conversation, which I don't know the answer to, around land, I think, and what it means to try to make a home in a place where maybe it's just sort of you're kind of in this system of evils begetting evils, right? Like, the first evil is that is the displacement and murder of indigenous people, but then the second evil is slavery, like, if we were to date them or something, you know what I mean? And but then what do you do, right? Like, you're left to make choices about where you can be and where you can live that are always compromised because of the first compromise. And so that's also, like, who I think about a lot. And then after that, I think just sort of, I think a lot about particularly parents, you know, because I think it's beyond all of it's, you know, and the way I'm talking about this, it sort of sounds as though this book is just entirely, like, the most political thing, like a pamphlet. It's not. Like, it's very much, you know, I don't sort of write from up here down to here. I write down here up to here. So all of this has to be embedded inside characters who are moving. Like, that's the first priority. And I think one of the things here is that these folks are, you know, it's also a book about a fractured family, right? That's fractured by geography and by circumstance and certainly by history and economics, but also by their own proclivities and the stupid stuff that they did and the mistakes that they make.
Also, like, they like to have sex.
They really do. Yeah, people really enjoy having
sex. I don't want anybody to get the wrong in this book.
Even the old lady is like, what? Everyone have more sex.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Yes, old ladies are mourning the fact that there's no one to have sex with. Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to do a lightning round. I feel like we're closing it. Don't think about it.
Okay.
Just answer.
Okay.
Moby Dick or Middlemarch?
Moby Dick.
Soft pretzels or water ice? You can only eat one for the rest of your life.
Rest of my life?
Yeah, rest of your life. Soft pretzels or water ice?
Soft pretzels.
Okay. South Street or Rittenhouse Square?
Rittenhouse Square.
East Mount Airy or West Mount Airy?
Ooh. See, that's a political question.
And that's a lightning round.
West.
Boo. No, I'm just kidding. I don't even. Okay, so now, to save your life, you either have to double dutch or roller skate.
Roller skate.
Central or Girls High?
Girls High.
I knew what you were going to say, but I just had to ask anyway. All right. Do you have any other burning things you want to tell the people?
I do not have burning things.
Oh, somebody is going to ask you this. Mm. They're going to say, who are your favorite writers and books? So I already did it for them.
Jesus. It's so hard.
I know, and
it's
you're going to
so
say
impossible.
That. But yeah.
It's so impossible.
Okay, what's one book that you really like and you think everybody should read?
Okay, I'll give you two.
Okay.
One is Louise Erdrich's Plague of Doves.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, all the Louise Erdrich.
All the Louise Erdrich. The Louise I'm like Erdrich. A Louise Erdrich super, like, obsessive super fan.
Yeah.
And also, out of left field a little bit, Catherine Dunn's Geek Love, which I'm reading now. If you don't know this book, it is a singular phenomenon of a novel. Like, it is unprecedented.
Yeah.
No,
it
universe.
Was one of those things that came and was a big deal and then kind of really went away.
But yeah. And I don't know why, because it is like ever fresh and always like, how? It's one of those books that you're just like, how did she do this?
Yeah. No, it's good. All right. Thank you for answering my questions.
Oh, my goodness. Thank you for the lightning round.
Okay.
People should ask questions. I love
questions.
Yeah,
you should ask questions.
I really do love questions.
Yeah.
Oh, look, there's hands. Akiba should be first because Akiba and I work together. She's getting preference many years ago.
I just wanted to know, how did teaching affect your writing of your second novel? Because you weren't teaching during the time that you wrote your first one, right?
It's a sort of double-edged sword. So on the one hand, I learned a lot from my students, and I learned a lot through talking about writing with my students. You know, I've been blessed to have these like genius students, you know? So the conversations that we had to have about our work had to be like way up here. Like I had to bring my A game every week, you know? Which means I learned a lot. The hard thing though is I had to bring my A game every week, which means that like the part of my brain that maybe I need to use for writing is sort of in teaching mode. And also, I mean, I teach writing and also literature. And so when I'm teaching literature, it's super nourishing. Teaching writing is different, right? It's even though the level, or maybe because the level of many of my students is really high, you know, what we're doing is people bring work into class and we think about what that thing is and what that student wants to make and what the obstacles are to it becoming the thing that that student wants it to be, which means that in order to do that and for me to guide a discussion about it, I am essentially at home for a week, like, dissembling that work into its parts so that I can figure out what it wants to do and then figure out how we could rebuild it to the shape of what the student wants. That, of course, is really not the sort of thing that you want when you're trying to generate work, right? Like, you don't want to be in, like, super editor dissemble mode. Like, it does not help you. So it's double-edged. On the one hand, inspiring, learn so much. On the other hand, I can't necessarily do them at the same time, actually.
Hi.
Hello.
I loved 12 Tribes of Hattie.
Thank you.
I've read it like 4 times. I don't know if it's possible to ask 2 questions. One's kind of easy, or maybe easy, and one may not be.
I think it's fine to ask
okay,
2 questions.
Okay, what's the significance of the color orange?
Oh, that doesn't, I just like orange.
Just like orange. Okay, cool. See, that was quick. How do you think setting your books in Philadelphia, or what do you think setting your books in Philadelphia brings to the characters or to the story? Because I think about, when I discovered your first novel, I think about Toni Morrison and how she sets a lot of things in Ohio. Mm-hmm. And I really appreciate it as a Philadelphian, it being set, or pieces of it being in Philadelphia. So do you think that Philadelphia adds something to the novels or to the people in the novels?
I mean, I don't even know if I would say it's a question of adding something. Like, I think that they are just like organic to Philadelphia, right? Like, I don't think that they could take place somewhere else. You know what I mean? Like, it's so integral that there would be a different novel with different people with different everything if they were set somewhere else. That said, I do think, you know, I left Philadelphia. Well, the first time I left, I was 18, and then I came back for a little while, and then I left again when I was 22, which, you know, was of course only 5 or 6 years ago. But y'all weren't supposed to laugh. Anyhow, until very recently, my mom was here, and I would come back like very, very frequently. But the point I'm trying to make, I guess, is in some ways, like, the Philadelphia that I write about is a Philadelphia of the mind. I'm stealing a concept from Salman Rushdie, who wrote an incredible essay called Imaginary Homelands about immigrating. And he talked about, you know, he talked about leaving home and then setting these novels in Pakistan and things like that. But the place he was writing is not a place that exists anymore. It's in his mind, right? And it's these fragments that are pieced together, but that become very powerful because they're fragments. And I think that there's something analogous to that in the way that I think about Philadelphia, right? Like, the Philadelphia of my teenage and sort of tween years of the 1980s, of course, doesn't exist at all in any way, shape, or form anymore. But it is the Philadelphia that is sort of the most resonant and the most deeply in my imagination, along with a Philadelphia that I never experienced at all. You know, my aunt's Philadelphia, she's sitting behind you, and my mother's Philadelphia, which is a Philadelphia of the 30s and 40s and 50s, which, you know, which I didn't live in, but that was so much a part of the ether of my growing up, and the spirit of those people that it also was sort of with me in very intense ways.
I don't have a question, but I have a comment. On behalf of the Alumni Association of the Philadelphia High School for Girls, we want to say thank you for making time for us to do the author talk in September as you were on your quest to promote your new book. And we have a little something for you
Aww.
That we'd like to present to you.
Oh, my goodness. I will come and get it afterwards. No, no, I want to hug her, so I'll come get it afterwards because I want to
say thank you. I was your co-moderator for that event.
I know.
And we are so proud of you. If you remember our school song, our alma mater, where it says, "To her we laurels bring," and we want to thank you for bringing the laurels back to our alma mater.
Oh, thank you. You know, the girl side thing is no joke. Thank you. Thank you. Is that Emily Rabiteau's brother? Yeah. It is. Hi.
I was just interested in what you were saying about how you had with talking to characters and sound. I was wondering, like, do you, and your reading was so, your cadence was so beautiful, your presentation was so musical. I wonder if you speak to yourself actually while you write, or if you use sound in any way to produce your work.
Mm. Yes, I speak to myself actually a lot in general, which I should not admit probably. Half jokes aside, I read aloud a lot, and it sort of, and when I read aloud, I'm checking for sound, because I also find that not always. Well, if you read aloud, you know, it's like your voice will catch, really, like when there's a wrong note. You know, it's like music. You know, like you instantly all of us do, right? Like a wrong note in anything, like we all, you know, something in you just recognizes it. And the same thing for me tends to happen with, and I think with, it's what I tell my students, with sentences, right? Like if there's a wrong word, the rhythm is wrong, like my voice will catch quite literally. And then I'm like, okay, well, you know, I've got to deal with that. And sometimes that's helping just on the level of sound and like sort of the musicality and the rhythm of the sentences. But sometimes it also helps enormously with meaning, right? Like, because the other thing is that, that wrong word might not sound great, but it also might not be the right word at all. And so the whole sort of sense of the sentence is also really intertwined with the sound of the sentences, if that makes any sense. And all these high school friends that are there, they're sitting over there. They, you know, I thought for a long time in my earlier and younger life that I was going to be a poet. We should all be grateful that I didn't do that. It would be really just a lot of mediocre poetry. But I will say that in terms of sort of training, it was like essential. I mean, it teaches you everything about like economy of language, about rhythm, about sound, a sort of respect for the materials that you build with, you know what I mean? Like, a lot of time of my life spent writing bad poetry, but reading a lot of good poetry, which I still do. And so that also has been really, really important.
Did you read this entire book aloud? I do that now when I have a final draft.
Right?
Did you? No, but the whole thing. Did
I
you
didn't
do
read
that?
The whole thing because I was okay. Just like, you know, it's a little bit. Like sometimes it's just like, oh, that's discouraging. But but many, many sections.
Yeah, yeah.
Many, many sections. Yeah. You read a whole book. Will you read the whole thing?
Now, at the end of the whole thing.
Like you'll go like page one to page whatever.
At the end of the whole thing.
That's impressive. Like the end, like it's edited, or the end, like you're about to hand it in?
No, the end, like it's about to go to the copy.
Oh, it's going.
It's over.
Ooh.
Like, yeah.
You are a brave woman. I was like, I can't face this. I'm just going to hope for the best.
It takes forever.
A coward. Yeah. Also, that must take quite a lot of time.
But, I mean, my books are a lot shorter than this, though.
This book is annoyingly long. I didn't want to. I was like, it's going to be 225 pages, which is sort of arbitrary, but that's what I decided. No, and it was not true.
Yeah.
I just wanted to know, are you working on the... Are you working on the third book?
Oh, God, no.
I just didn't want to wait another 10 years.
I God bless you and thank you, but no. Not at the moment, let's say. Mm-mm. I hope it won't be 10 years. That's too long, I think, yeah.
Hi, my name's Gina.
Hey, Gina.
How about some short stories? Maybe that would be better.
I'm not,
short stories.
That is not my gift.
Yeah.
That is not my gift. It's just I read a lot of them. I teach them, but it's my, you know, I try to write a short story and it just ends up being like, but what about the uncle? And what about 10 years before that? And what about their grandmother? And what do you suppose happened to that dog? So, and it just balloons into this like unwieldy thing. So that, yeah, no, that is not compression. As you can tell from my answers, compression is not my gift.
One other question was, some of the imagery was like so beautiful and on such like a mythical scale. Hmm. But I was wondering, like with the starlings and the murmuration, and then the image of the mother, so inaccessible and high, like a mountain, lonely mountain. Do you collect images or dreams? Do you like write down things like that touch you to use, like as a collage almost, or like a running collection of images that mean something to you?
You know, I wish that I did. You know, I aspire to be one of those people that like wakes up when they have a weird dream and then they write it down. I've never done that. If I wake up from a dream, like, and then I just try to go back to sleep. That said, I don't know. So I don't do that. And I don't, you know, I have writer friends. Do you have a notebook? Do you wander around with a notebook that you're writing? Yeah, no, I wish I was one of those people.
I'm like, I'll totally remember that.
And you never do, right? So same. So I don't have a notebook. So mostly I forget probably a good 90% of the ideas I've ever had. But that said, you know, strange things happen that I think I'm sometimes totally not completely aware of. So a couple of days ago, I got this book that I needed for something totally unrelated to this book. Probably it was a teaching thing. I don't remember why I was looking for it. So I get the book off the bookshelf, and I was looking for a specific section. So I'm like flipping through looking for the section, and I see this kind of like bright fuchsia post-it note. And I always use the bright ones because my brain is like a little like weird bird. So like I need like shiny, colorful things to attract my attention. So I'm looking through this bright fuchsia note, and all it's like in a book that I haven't opened in probably 5 or 6 years, and all it says in capital letters, underlined with 3 exclamation points, is guns. And I was just like, what? Like, what am I doing? So I think, you know, and there are actually like quite clearly that was a note that was to myself about something in this book. Like this book is about, not about, but I mean, certainly there's a lot of like state violence and there's police violence and there's people having both offensive and defensive violence. And so there are guns in this book. And so I guess I was trying, I don't know what that was, because there was no elaboration. It just said guns. With like a lot, you know, so like that's not an image, but I think that there, I do find after when I'm done writing a thing, this sort of weird like snail trail of like of the little remnants of my brain do functionings, you know what I mean, with no context, which are more alarming than comforting actually, But in any case, I mean, that doesn't really answer your question, but it does, that there are these little bits that get kind of left around that you find later and are confused by or something. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming, everybody. Thank you, Asali, for being amazing.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit, and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.